normally think of himself as philosophically or politically confused, but after rereading this file, he found himself deeply conflicted about whether or not John Voss's parents should be summarily executed, assuming they could be located. On the one hand, he had never favored capital punishment, reasoning that it didn't really solve the problem it was intended to address. But in this instance, the problem it would solve, quite elegantly, he thought, was the disgust he felt at the idea of sharing the world with these two particular people. Not that he considered himself an ideal parent, far from it. He and Anne had indulged their son, Adam, beyond reckoning, and as a result, the boy was showing signs of a distinctly unrealistic worldview. He seemed, for example, to believe the world was kindly disposed toward him as a matter of course. Otto had been ineffectual in the area of discipline for too long, but now, he suspected, it was too late to start doing things differently. Earlier in the year, when he'd caught his son at a party that featured both alcohol and drugs, he'd told the boy he was grounded until further notice. Adam nearly busted a gut, laughing on his way out the door. The word Adam himself applied to his father's parenting skills was clueless, and Otto had come to accept this as his due. He didn't like to think where his failure had begun, because whenever he tried to, he could taste that failure commingling with minty antacid on the back of his tongue. The simplest conclusion was that he'd gone into parenthood with an overly modest game plan, by promising himself he would never be the living torment to his son that his own father had been to him. In this, apparently, he'd succeeded. Adam seemed genuinely fond of both his parents without feeling the slightest obligation to listen to anything they said. His customary, "Right, Dad," did not, Otto now understood, connote agreement or even comprehension. Anne was of the opinion that all this was quite natural, that what her husband was always trying to explain to her as he lay in the dark, unable to sleep, that they somehow failed to prepare their son for the real world, was silly. Adam suffered from nothing more serious than adolescence, a disease that would eventually pass, like a particularly virulent episode of chickenpox. Ugly to look at, but temporary and certainly not life-threatening. The boy knew he was loved, she reminded him, which struck Otto as the last feeble hope of the truly clueless parent. They'd made every mistake in the book. No, Otto thought, as he climbed the rickety porch steps and rang the bell. Somehow he and Anne had managed to raise their son without stuffing him into laundry bags or bringing him up in a house as haunted as this one. The boy had warned him that he might have to ring the bell several times. His grandmother was hard of hearing, and her bedroom, which she seldom left anymore, was all the way in the back. The principal had lied, of course, in explaining that he had some papers she needed to sign. The boy had offered to get her signature that evening, but he'd said no. He wanted to speak with her personally, in case there was anything the school could do to help. A terrible lie, now that he thought about it. The boy's eyes had darted here and there nervously, never making contact with his own, but he seemed more anxious and embarrassed than panicked. "Yes, it was true," he confessed. His grandmother had disconnected the phone last spring to spare the expense. The only calls they ever got were nuisance ones anyway. When Otto asked whether she'd considered how unsafe it might be to live so far out of town without a telephone for emergencies, he'd replied, "That's what I'm for. Emergencies." Of the two interviews, the one with the Voss boy had been less disturbing than the one with Zach Minty. "How did you get into the cafeteria?" the principal asked, once they were back in his office. "It was open." "No, it's locked after fourth period." "They must have forgot." "Shall I call Mrs. Wilson?" "Go ahead. Anyway, it was open." "Did you get your friends to let you in?" "It was open." "It was not open." Sullen, then, just sitting there, this boy who would clearly make it through his entire adult life without resorting to antacids, smug, self-satisfied, a minty through and through. The boy's grandfather, William, kept his freezer full of illegal deer and moose meat and was a wife-beater back when that particular crime was still considered a private matter. A shifty, brutal, lifelong scofflaw, in and out of jail for the sorts of petty crimes that suggested more a lack of imagination than an unwillingness to commit more serious offenses. He was also, according to rumor, the man the Whitings had turned to when one of their mills was in danger of going pro-union, and they'd needed a couple of key heads cracked. As for the father, the shady Jimmy Minty, now rumored to be the town's next police chief, he collected two paychecks, one official, the other under the table, from Francine Whiting. And now this late hit artist, young Zack, another apple that hadn't fallen far from the tree. In Otto's opinion, he would wind up a lawbreaker like his grandfather, or a corrupt enforcer like his father, but he'd be trouble either way. Unless the unlucky girl he married shot him, as Jimmy's wife had threatened on several occasions before she ran off, he'd escape justice entirely. The principal picked up the hall pass the boy had flourished. "What class do you have with Mrs. Rodrigue?"
"I don't have one with her."
"Then why would she give you a pass?"
"I guess she likes me."
"Why would she do that?"
"Why would she like me?"
Actually, that was exactly what Otto wanted to know, but he decided to rephrase the question. "No. Why would she give you a hall pass?"
A shrug. "We go to the same church. Plus she's my aunt or something. My mother's sister is her brother's wife, whatever that is."
"What that is no reason to give you a hall pass. Did you forge your signature?"
"No way I'd do that."
"Why not?"
"Because you could find out."
"Not because it would be wrong?"
"That too, I guess."
"I don't want to see you in that cafeteria again during fifth period. Agreed?" Another shrug. "Do you understand? I'll be checking." Suddenly, he had a brainstorm. "Did you write this?" Zack Minty leaned forward, took the page and read it, then handed it back with what might have been a trace of a smile.
"No."
Of course he had. Otto was suddenly certain of it. John Voss's grandmother had a name, Charlotte Owen, and whoever wrote the note didn't know this, and either had no idea how to find out or was too lazy. A kid then, this kid. "Not the kind of thing you'd do?" After expressing great perplexity at this question, he shook his head.
"No."
"Because it would be wrong, or because you'd get caught?"
"How would I get caught?"
"Why do you and your friends torment John Voss?"
"We don't."
"What do you get out of it?"
"I said we don't."
As Otto started out of the building, the class bell rang, and he saw Doris Rodrigue standing in the doorway to her classroom. "Don't ever let me catch that Minty kid with another hall pass signed by you," he told her, not caring particularly whether any students overheard or not. When she began to say something, he handed her the hall pass. "Never again. Is that understood?" Outside, he just sat in the Buick until he calmed down. He didn't give a hoot about Doris Rodrigue, but the Minty boy's last words were still ringing in his ears. When he was told he could leave, he'd gotten to his feet slowly, as if disappointed that their conversation had come to an end. He was limping, Otto noticed, no doubt to remind the principal that he played football and had been injured for the greater glory of Empire High. At the door, the kid stopped and looked off at an oblique angle. "Where is John Voss's grandmother?" he said, as if the odd nature of the question had just occurred to him. "Huh." The back door, like the front, was locked. Otto shouldn't have tried it, but he did. After all, what would he have done if it was unlocked? Enter without invitation? After knocking several times, loudly, he went back down the porch steps and stood in plain sight, calling up to what he hoped was the old woman's bedroom window, identifying himself and trying to look harmless and unthreatening in case she was peering out from behind the curtains. It occurred to him that perhaps she had heard him ringing the bell out front. Perhaps it even looked out from behind the thick curtains that shrouded the front windows, and seeing a stranger there, become terrified. He even imagined her lying in a heap just inside the door, a stroke victim, and himself the cause. How would he go about explaining that? After all, there were no papers for the old woman to sign, simply his cold, intellectual curiosity, the need to know the answer to a question posed by a cruel prankster. Where is John Voss's grandmother? As if that were any of Otto Meyer Jr.'s business. Standing in the middle of Charlotte Owen's weedy lawn and staring up at the dark curtained window, Otto could feel, despite the cold air, clammy perspiration tracking down his right side from his armpit. His nerve failing him, he was about to leave when he noticed the rusty iron stake. Because of the contour of the ground, only the top of it was visible from the base of the porch. But coming closer, he could see that attached to it was a sturdy chain, and at the end of the chain, a metal clasp. Otto Meyer looked around for the canine suggested by these details, but there was no doghouse nearby, no water bowl back on the porch, and, of course, no dog had barked when he rang the bell. He kicked aside a clump of something that might have been an ancient fossilized dog turd, or perhaps just a clod of earth. Otherwise, the ground was bare. Funny how the mind works, Otto considered. This time when he turned back to the house and stared at the curtained second-floor window, he was sure he hadn't given Charlotte Owen a stroke by ringing her doorbell and pounding insistently on her back door. Charlotte Owen was not home, and hadn't been for some time. The boy was living in the house alone. A stake in the ground with a chain attached didn't prove any of this. Probably Otto had to admit it didn't even suggest it, but he was certain all the same. At the foot of the porch, he found a stone that was about the right size. The thing to do was call the cops, of course, but that might mean Jimmy Minty, and Otto had had enough of the Minty family for one day. If it turned out he was wrong and the whole thing backfired, he could always claim he'd heard the old woman inside calling for help. A wind had, in fact, sprung up, and the moaning it made in the surrounding trees did sound a little like an old woman's lament. Feeble, but it would have been his story. If he was wrong, except he wasn't. Strange, too, that being sure had settled his stomach. Once again he climbed the back steps. At the door he didn't hesitate before breaking the small pane of glass nearest the doorknob and reaching through the jagged opening to let himself in. The Empire Grill had a closed sign hanging in the window, but when Miles saw it was Otto Meyer, he went over and unlocked the door. All right, he said. I'll stand for school board, but I'm telling you right now, I don't have time to campaign. Thanks, Otto said, as Miles closed and relocked the door behind them. You won't have to campaign, I promise. When people see you're on the ballot, they'll make their mark right by your name. Over at the counter, Otto recognized a couple of the regulars Miles allowed to hang around drinking coffee after the lunch crowd cleared out. Horace Weymouth, the reporter, who usually covered the school budget wars, was there, and Walt Como, who owned the club out by the strip mall and who just married Miles's ex. It was a little on the chilly side in the restaurant, but Walt had stripped down to his white cotton T-shirt. Maybe it was warmer over by the grill.
Big boy, Walt Como bellowed. Get back over here. Let's settle this right now. No more running away.
Miles ignored him. You want a cup of coffee, Meyer? Otto laid a hand over his stomach. Have a heart, will you? Glass of warm milk? He started to say no, then reconsidered. You know what? I hope you weren't joking, because that sounds wonderful. Grab a seat. Okay if we sit over there? He motioned to the far booth, which a group of girls with large, elaborate hairdos was just vacating. Miles nodded. Otto said hello to the girls, one or two of whom he recognized from their thinner high school days, then slid into the booth. While Miles took care of their check and let them out, he consolidated their plates and coffee cups, wiping the table clean with a lipstick-smudged napkin. That was quick, he said, when Miles handed him his milk, warm in its glass. The beauty of the microwave, Miles admitted, sitting down.
Big boy! Walt bellowed again.
Miles sighed. Be right there. What's all that about? Otto couldn't help asking, since the very idea of Walt Como in Miles Roby's restaurant was strange enough. He's always trying to get me to arm wrestle him. Why? You'd have to ask him. It seems to have something to do with his belief that one of us isn't a real man. You know what? You don't look so hot. Otto shrugged. Your new busboy working today? John? He was supposed to come in for a couple hours to clean up the lunch stuff, but he hasn't turned up. Until today, he's been real reliable. If he shows up, I'd appreciate your giving me a call. Okay, Miles said. Is he in some kind of trouble, Meyer? None of my business, except for Tick. She here? At home. I just talked to her. Good, Otto said. I just feel sick about this, Miles. I'm the one who asked her to be nice to the kid. Miles sat up straighter in the booth. You better tell me, Meyer. Now Otto sighed. I don't know. Maybe everything's all right. I'm gonna have to get to the bottom of it, though.
Big boy! Name that tune!
Walt spun off his stool and danced his crooner's jig as he came toward them, singing,
Never dreamed anybody could kiss that away. Bring me bliss that away. What a kiss that away. What a wonderful feeling to feel that away. Tell me, where have you been all my life?
Go away, Walt, Miles said. I'm having a conversation here. Okay, I'll give you one hint, Walt said.
Who do I always sing?
Miles just stared at him. And what occurred to Otto Meyer was that if Miles had worn that expression while talking to him, he, by God, would have done as he was told. Instead, Walt slid into the booth on Otto's side.
You know something? I'll admit it. I might give him shit all the time, but I love this guy. That's the truth. Can you believe he actually came to my wedding? Pure class is what that is. But I'm still gonna whip his ass. I'm wrestling.
And with that, he reached across the table and gave Miles a friendly cuff on the side of the head. Then, noticing that Horace Weymouth was making for the door, Walt called after him,
Where are you sneaking off to?
Horace, ignoring him, nodded to Miles.
No court in the land would ever convict you, he said.
5 minutes later, they had the place to themselves. And since there was nothing to do but address the situation, Otto Meyer explained that the boy's legal guardian was not in residence at the house out on the old landfill road, that the old woman's clothes were hanging in the bedroom closet, the house was full of furniture, the kitchen with pots and pans, that there was nothing to indicate that Charlotte Owen had abandoned the boy as his parents had done. And yet she wasn't there. I think the boy's living out there by himself, he concluded. I think he has been for some time. Could she be in the hospital? I thought of that, Otto Meyer said. In fact, before coming to the Empire Grill, he'd returned to his office and made several phone calls. Charlotte Owen was admitted to Dexter Memorial in Fairhaven last April with pneumonia, released 2 weeks later. She hasn't been readmitted since. Still, that's not all. There hasn't been any electrical power or telephone service since the end of March, and when I turned on the tap in the kitchen, the faucet was dry. Well, good God, Meyer, she can't have died. It's the sort of thing people hear about. It makes the newspaper. I know, Otto admitted, finishing the last of his warm milk. That had been another of his calls, to the county courthouse. No death certificate had been filed in the name of Charlotte Owen. No elderly woman's body awaited identification at the morgue. Keep talking, you're making me feel better. There has to be some explanation. Otto pushed the empty glass over to where he'd stacked the girl's dishes and cups. I know that too. The problem is the one I keep coming up with is that Charlotte Owen died last spring after she returned home to a house with no heat, and that boy hasn't told a soul. Then where is she, Meyer? For a moment, Otto considered telling his old friend about the three letters he'd received asking this very question, but he decided against it. Odd how the meaning of the question changed entirely depending on whether it referred to a living woman or a dead one. But there was one thing Miles did have a right to know, and that was about the laundry bag. "You didn't hear this from me," he began, aware that he was violating the confidentiality of a student's file. By the time he finished, Miles had gone as white as his apron. It was after midnight when Otto Meyer got home. The first thing he did was go into his son's room, where Adam lay asleep. As usual, he'd gone to bed without turning off his computer. The screensaver he'd chosen some time ago was a human skull that grinned out at the world before fragmenting, then dissolving, then coming back together to grin anew. Otto, exhausted and suddenly on the verge of tears, shut it off, and then sat there in the dark for a few minutes, watching his son breathe by the light that filtered in from the hall. Later, when he entered the bedroom he shared with his wife of 22 years, Anne was asleep with the television on, tuned to one of the banger stations now off the air, but where the story had run on the 11 o'clock news. Tomorrow? He didn't even want to think about that. In a few short hours, the lawn outside would be crawling with reporters. He undressed quickly and slid into bed next to his wife, who woke up and took his hand. "I'm sorry," she said. "I meant to stay awake." "Tomorrow," he said, "if you think of it, will you call David Irving and see if you can get me an appointment? Your stomach?" No need to answer this. "They still haven't located the boy?" "They will tomorrow." "What will happen to him?" "I have no idea." "What will happen to us?" "We'll survive," Otto told her. She was right, of course. This was the sort of thing high school principals lost their jobs over, and probably, though he would never say this to Anne, should lose their jobs over. "It'll start early," he told her, giving her hand a squeeze before reaching up to turn out the lamp. "We should sleep if we can." What he meant was that she should sleep. Sleep was pretty much out of the question for him, exhaustion or no exhaustion. In the dark bedroom, the events of the afternoon and evening grew even more vivid. It was Bill Dawes he had called with his suspicions, even confessing that he'd broken into the old woman's house. When he'd finished, the police chief said simply, "Meet me there." He'd waited out in the car while Dawes and Jimmy Minty and another policeman searched the entire premises. Otto had not himself gone into either the attic or the cellar, of course, but even taking into account that there was no light in the house to search by, it had taken a very long time to ascertain officially what everyone seemed to know from the beginning. Bill had had a radiation treatment that morning, and when he came back out of the house with Minty, both men silent, he did not look well. Minty went over to his cruiser and talked on the radio.
"Well," Bill Dawes said, "I suppose the good news is that we don't know for sure that she isn't off visiting her sister or something."
Otto was grateful to hear this possibility given voice. It was the very straw he'd been clinging to.
"I got a bad feeling, though," the police chief added.
"Me too, Bill. Me too.
Anyway, neither of them's here, so why don't you go on home?"
He nodded, understanding that the only reason Bill Dawes had wanted him there at all was in case the boy turned up. "I was thinking I'd go back into school."
"Whatever."
"Did you notice that steak out back?"
"I did."
"What did you make of it?"
"I'm trying not to think about it," Dawes admitted. "Listen, if this thing turns out bad, like I think it's going to, we won't be able to keep it quiet."
"I wouldn't ask you to." Dusk had fallen completely, and the two men heard the vehicles before the headlights cut through the darkness into the driveway. The first was some sort of police SUV with a German Shepherd pacing anxiously in back. The other was Jimmy Minty's Camaro, and when Zach got out, Meyer noticed again that he was limping. His father went over and they exchanged a few words, the boy glancing over at the principal and shaking his head. Then he got back in the Camaro and drove off, back toward town.
"What was that all about?" Bill Dawes wanted to know, when Jimmy Minty joined them. "I asked him if he wrote those notes," Minty explained, looking at Otto. "He didn't."
Bill nodded, said nothing. How come you people want to blame my boy for everything? What people are those? Otto said. At the school? You? Coach Town? Otto turned and looked Bill Dawes in the face. He wrote the notes. Yeah? Minty said. Prove it. All right, Bill said in a way that made it clear he'd had enough of this. See if you can get a hold of somebody at Central Maine Power, he told Minty, effectively dismissing him. We'll need some temporary power at this house. The officer who'd driven the SUV now had the German Shepherd on a leash. Where do you want us to start? He called over. Here at the house, I guess, Dawes said, his voice dispirited. It's over across the way. We'll find her, though. Which meant the police chief had thought of it, too. And this relieved Otto's fears that he might be the only one to whom such a horrible notion had occurred. Chapter 28 Janine got through her midday step class, after which she was supposed to work the desk, checking members in, and making the pain-in-the-ass protein shakes they served in the Fox's Den, the small lounge of half a dozen tables where the workmen's comp guys, assholes and scam artists every one, like to hang out after their physical therapy. Janine hated to look at them even on a good day, which this certainly was not. Not anymore. Not after going to the bank. She was still wobbly about the knees, truth be told, and not because she'd done her advanced step class on an empty stomach, either. The idea of food, normally a sweet, forbidden fantasy, made her stomach roil with what she couldn't imagine. "Still no sign of that Voss boy, is there?" Mrs. Newman, a short woman, had to peer around the cash register to see the TV hung from the ceiling in the Fox's Den while she waited for Janine to key in her membership number. The noon news broadcast was signing off now, urging viewers to stay tuned for the soap that followed. It had been 5 days since the woman's body had been discovered at the old landfill, though it wasn't really a body anymore. More of a skeleton, really, according to the newspaper. So little left after 6 months' exposure that positive identification would have to await dental records, wherever they might be. Charlotte Owen had outlived not only her friends, but also 3 Empire Falls dentists. The 4th, who apparently had her files, had retired somewhere in Florida. The boy, John Voss, had simply vanished. "Just goes to show," Mrs. Newman intoned. "Life is one big secret. You never even know who's living right next door." Which was not entirely apropos, Janine almost told her, since the old woman and the Voss boy hadn't had any neighbors. And anyway, never mind about not knowing who's next door. Half the time you don't even know who you're marrying until you go to pick up your license and happen to see by pure chance how old the fucker really is. Then, talk about your secrets. Just when you think you've straightened out the whole age thing and go ahead and marry the old fart anyway, against your better judgment, plus the advice of everybody you know, then you go to the bank and try to write a check on your joint account and whammo, there you are, wondering all over again just who is this son of a bitch anyway. Not that Janine would say any of this to Mrs. Newman. No more than she'd tell this human medicine ball to stop wasting her time and money at the club. 5 days a week, Mrs. Newman showed up at 1 o'clock, a busy time in the exercise room, and did her leisurely stroll on one of the 3 working treadmills, reading the free magazines and pissing off the members who are interested in real workouts. At the rate Mrs. Newman walked the goddamn treadmill, she could get as much good out of sitting in a chair and flipping through TV Guide. "Imagine that," Mrs. Newman said. "You live to be 80-some-odd years old, and one day the good Lord decides you're all done, and your own grandson takes you out to the dump and leaves you there. I swear to heaven I just don't know anymore." "Me either, Mrs. Newman," Janine said, picking up the phone to dial Amber, who was always looking for extra hours. "Must have just slung that poor old woman over his shoulder," the woman said, slinging her own workout bag over her own round shoulder, where it slipped off again halfway to the woman's locker room door.
Probably what'll happen to me, if it's that one grandson of mine that finds me. Not unless he rents a forklift, Janine muttered, as the door swung shut behind her.
Get here as quick as you can, she snapped into the phone when Amber agreed to come in and finish Janine's shift. Before I do something I'll regret.
This exact opportunity presented itself the moment she hung up, when the workmen's comp table called for another round of light beers, which they believed they could drink all afternoon without getting drunk or gaining weight. This, despite the fact that they left drunk every afternoon, their heavy beer guts sloshing. The worst of the lot was Randy Danilak, who had been a year ahead of Janine, though he had no recollection of her in high school, though she'd stared at him dreamily for two straight years. She suspected that not one of these Goldbricks was actually injured, but most at least had the decency to pretend. Danilak just preferred working 2 or 3 days a week instead of the full 5, so he collected comp from one Empire Falls contractor and worked off the books for another in Fairhaven. According to medical affidavits, he was supposedly unable to stand up straight, a condition that didn't prevent him from playing racquetball whenever he could find an opponent who didn't mind being called names after every point.
"Why, thank you, darling," he said, when she delivered their round of light beers. He looked her over good, too, something she normally wouldn't have minded, then gave her one of his crooked smiles. "Married life seems to agree with you. Nothing like getting it regular, is there?"
When he said this, Janine finally glimpsed the appeal of the irony her ex-husband was always trying to get her to appreciate while she was trying to get him to appreciate sex. Irony was one of the many things wrong between them right from the start. Janine simply wasn't the sort of woman, and she freely admitted this, who benefited from constantly having the concept of irony explained to her. Yet in the present instance, the irony of her high school devotion through her entire 16th and 17th years to a man who grew up to become about the worst cheating rat bastard in town, well, it was inescapable. No, that wasn't ironic. It was the fact that he'd finally noticed her and wanted to screw her that was ironic.
"You know what, Randy," she said, "you can just eat me, okay?"
And she was out the door before it occurred to him to take her up on the offer. The sad truth, Janine had to admit as she drove over to the Empire Grill, was that she'd gone and divorced a man she could talk to and married one she couldn't. Her need to talk to somebody right this second probably qualified as yet another irony, as was the realization that she missed Miles's calm, quiet ways. Since the separation, she'd grown nostalgic about them. And since marrying Walt, she'd begun to recall her old life with Miles with a wistful fondness, which she had to remind herself was simple lunacy. Sure, Miles had been a good listener, and a listener was exactly what she needed at this particular moment. But what they never told you was that good listeners could be maddening as hell. He had to weigh everything you told him, as if making sure that he understood every last nuance was the only thing standing between him and offering a perfect solution. Either that or he'd treat her like she was just talking to hear herself talk, which also drove her batshit. She tried explaining all this to her mother once, which was a mistake. For a bartender, B wasn't much of a listener, as quick with a diagnosis as Miles was slow. "What you don't realize," her mother told her, "is that it's really you driving yourself batshit. You can't ever be content with anything, even for a minute. Miles doesn't say anything because there isn't a damn thing to say." Which was why she was driving over to the Empire Grill instead of to Callahan's. Better to talk to a man with no answers than a woman with all the wrong ones. Miles was also far less likely to say, "I told you so," her mother's favorite words. "Well, for heaven's sake, Janine," she could hear her mother say after she'd explain her discovery this morning that the silver fox, who was forever rubbing his chin in contemplation of his next move, whose only concern seemed to be timing, didn't even have enough capital to invest in a week's vacation out in Arizona, where they had all those good-looking Latino masseurs to rub you down with oil. "Whatever made you think that Walt Como did have two nickels to rub together?"
her mother would ask, pure know-it-all that she was. At least Miles could be counted on to sympathize with the person, to register surprise at the fact that Walt didn't even own the building that housed his health club, but rented it from that damn Whiting woman who owned the Empire Grill in half the town. Her husband also rented most of the equipment in the exercise room. Hell, there wasn't a single aspect of the operation that wasn't leveraged to the hilt. There were even two mortgages on that little piece of shit house he was renting out since he'd moved in with her. And if he actually owned that parcel out on Small Pond Road, where he was always thinking out loud they might build a camp one of these days when the time was right, then Harold Dufresne down at Empire Fidelity didn't know a damn thing about it. And he would, too, since everything else the Silver Fox owned was held by Harold as collateral on the health club. Walt had even borrowed money for the ring and the half-assed weekend honeymoon on the coast, during which it should have occurred to her, if she'd had a brain in her head, why Walt liked sex so much. It was free. How in the world, she wanted to know, had she managed to put herself into a situation where the person she most wanted to unburden her soul to was the man she couldn't wait to leave so she'd be free to create the mess? These were all ironies, no doubt about it. And she hated every one of the fuckers, even before she turned onto Empire Avenue and saw the Silver Fox's van parked in front of the restaurant, which meant she couldn't very well have her talk with Miles, not with her husband sitting there at the counter. Life was secrets, as the horrible Mrs. Newman said, and for better or worse, stupid words she'd said not once but twice, she was wed to both the Silver Fox and the secret she had to keep. He'd known all along, of course, that when Janine found out, she'd just have to swallow everything whole. Worse, she knew the time to begin was right now. Just park next to her husband's van, go inside, and pretend that getting it regular agreed with her. Stand next to Walt and watch him lose their pennies to Horace at gin. Then slip her hand in his trouser pocket and reassure herself of the one thing the dumb son of a bitch did have to offer. Maybe tomorrow she'd be able to. In fact, she'd have to. But not right this minute, she decided. No, she knew where the steak knives were kept. And if she went in there right now, she might race around the counter, pull one out, and cut off her nose to spite her face. Janine drove on past the restaurant. Since the town's only unmarked police car wasn't in its usual spot in the alley next to the closed Firestone shop, Janine did a squealing U-turn and headed back up Empire the way she'd come. She'd gone about four blocks when she noticed the tall, skinny figure of her daughter making her solitary way up the street, leaning forward as usual under the weight of her backpack. When Janine tooted and pulled over to the curb, her daughter regarded the Jeep suspiciously, as if the Silver Fox might be scrunched down in the back seat somewhere. She came up to the car reluctantly. "Where are you headed?" Janine said, when she'd rolled down the window and her daughter tentatively bent forward to peer inside. "Grandma's?" "Climb in." Janine leaned across to open the door, ignoring her daughter's expression, which suggested that she'd just been ordered to push the vehicle up the street. Opening the rear door, Tick turned and backed into the opening, resting the bottom of her backpack on the seat and then walking out from under it, a maneuver so graceful and practiced that Janine's eyes filled with tears. At that age, she hadn't simply been overweight but also clumsy, always tripping and bumping into things. Tick had the kind of grace you were born with, that you couldn't starve or stairmaster yourself into, that you probably didn't even recognize unless you lacked it. "What's at Grandma's?" Janine asked. Well, sure, the kid also had a knack for looking at her mother in a way that inspired violence. Grandma, her daughter's expression now seemed to convey, was at Grandma's. "It's quiet down there, okay? I can do my homework," Tick finally explained, when it became clear that Janine wasn't going to pull away from the curb until she got a straight answer. "Nobody bothers me," she added. Nobody like Walt, was what she was saying. Nobody like Janine herself, probably. And no sooner did this thought occur to her than she was visited by a horrible mental picture of her daughter walking down the roadside at night, weighed down as usual, but not by her backpack. This time the load was Janine herself, and her daughter was headed for the dump. Every day this week she'd been meaning to talk with Tick about the Voss boy, who was all over the news and all anybody could seem to talk about, but somehow she'd managed not to. She knew Tick worked with the kid at the grill, and they were in the same art class, where they had both been picked for some show, which she'd been meaning to visit so she could see this snake picture she kept hearing about, but which her daughter hadn't ever even mentioned. True, Janine had been preoccupied with the wedding, but that wasn't much of an excuse. On the other hand, it wasn't much of a reason to imagine Tick hauling her carcass to the dump, either. Still, it was time to start making some of this shit between the two of them right. But as Janine began to formulate a question that would broach the subject of the Voss boy, she heard herself ask something easier. So, how come you never tell me any of those funny things you see on signs like you do with your father? Apparently, the answer was easy, too. You never think they're funny. Try me. No, her daughter said, making it a multisyllable sing-song word. And just that quickly, Janine was pissed off again. I'm not smart enough to see what's so damn funny, is that it? The little shit actually considered this question seriously before answering. You always get them. You just never think they're funny. Maybe they aren't. Then why do you want me to tell you one? Maybe I don't. Maybe I'd just like us to be friends, okay? Maybe I might like to take you to Boston for an art show sometime, if you'd ask me instead of your father. Maybe it would cheer me up to know my own daughter liked me. Walt isn't cheering you up? Janine pulled over 3 blocks short of her mother's tavern. Out! What? Well, at least that got the kid's attention. She was looking at Janine, scared now, aware she'd gone too far. Out! Janine repeated, not wanting to follow through but feeling she had to. You want to treat me like shit? You can damn well walk! What she was hoping was that her daughter would not do as she was told to. Not a lot to hope for, since she almost never did. But of course this time she would. Tick opened the door and got out, leaving Janine fresh out of options, trapped as usual. Rather than watch, she looked away, as if she couldn't care less, and when she heard the door slam, she glanced quickly over her left shoulder to make sure no traffic was coming down Empire Avenue, then jerked the wheel and stepped on the gas, hearing at the same instant her daughter yell, Stop! Her first thought was that her bluff had worked, that Tick wanted to apologize. But it was a more urgent scream than that. And when she looked back over her right shoulder, she took in what had happened in an instant. At the same time Tick had closed the front door, she'd opened the rear one to retrieve her backpack, hooking one of its straps in the crook of her elbow. All of this just as Janine had pulled out. And somehow, the pack had gotten wedged between the seat and the floor, yanking Tick off her feet. Only the back of her daughter's head was visible through the open door. But when Janine got around to the other side of the Jeep, she could see that Tick hadn't been seriously injured. In fact, thanks to the height of the vehicle, her daughter's behind was suspended an inch or two above the pavement. To Janine, she looked like a cartoon character whose parachute had failed to open. Nothing about her daughter's expression was comic, though. Her face had fragmented, then come together again in a mask of pain and fear and struggling rage. Get away from me! She screamed when Janine stooped to help unhook the backpack. Don't touch me! Stop this right now, Tick! Janine snapped, frightening herself. You're all right, I'm just trying to help. Then somehow her daughter was free and on her feet and walking away, rubbing her shoulder, sobbing as she went. Tick! Janine called, trying to sound stern, her voice cracking in betrayal. Come back here, please, sweetie! Nothing. She just kept on walking. There were maybe half a dozen people on the street, no more, but Janine was sure they'd all witnessed what had happened, and now were watching the scene play itself out. Tick! Her daughter whirled then. Leave! Me alone, she screamed, loud enough to be heard the length of Empire Avenue. The Jeep was still running, of course. Her daughter's backpack still wedged between the seats. And when Janine tried to close the door, it wouldn't. And then, after she'd given the backpack a swift kick, it still wouldn't. And then Janine herself was sobbing her frustrated heart out and kicking the door of the Grand Cherokee as hard as she could, the only pleasure left to her, that of seeing the dent grow and grow. And for how long did Janine Como, sob and rage and kick in the door of the Cherokee? Until it latched. Not completely, of course, because it couldn't, not with her daughter's burden wedged in so tightly, but at least tight enough that it wouldn't fly open. Janine was still shaking when she got back in behind the wheel. What she needed to do was to catch up with her daughter and make this right, by force if necessary. Set all of it right somehow, some way. She didn't know yet how, but by the time she pulled out onto Empire Avenue again, her daughter had disappeared. And it was too late, she realized, with one last sob. Too goddamn late. Chapter 29.
What do you figure all that's about? David wondered, when they passed the old shirt factory.
They were returning from B's Tavern in his pickup, and he slowed as they approached the corner of Empire Avenue. For the first time since the factory closed, at least as far as Miles could recall, the big iron gate was open. Just inside sat a white stretch limo with Massachusetts plates. Behind it, Miles caught a glint of red metal. On the steps of the old brick building, a group of men in dark suits were listening to a woman Miles immediately recognized as Mrs. Whiting.
"You don't suppose the rumors could be true?" Miles said. For weeks now, the grill had been alive with talk that a buyer had been found for the textile mill. As usual, Miles had dismissed this as needful speculation. Now, Mrs. Whiting's presence in the company of these suits would be enough to fuel foolish optimism through a long Maine winter.
"Be nice if something was going on," David admitted, turning onto Empire Avenue. "It would also explain why she's left us alone, if she's got bigger fish to fry."
It was still a bone of contention between them that Miles had not formally notified Mrs. Whiting of their intentions. From the start, Miles had allowed that his brother was probably right. But since that morning last month, when he recognized Charlie Maine in the newspaper photograph, he'd grown even more reluctant to confront Mrs. Whiting, as if he had been the one who betrayed her all those years ago on Martha's Vineyard. And even though it was crazy, he couldn't shake the conviction that Mrs. Whiting would be able to tell just by looking at him that he'd stumbled onto the truth at last. It had always seemed to Miles that she'd searched his face for signs of some particular understanding whenever they met. Then, finding none, she would allow things to proceed as usual. Intellectually, he knew his brother was right, that it was better to have everything out in the open. But his intuition counseled a more furtive course. Not that it was much of a secret anymore. He and David were now spending every free minute at Callahan's, Miles working late into the evenings, doing as much as possible himself, not wanting to start out any further in debt than they absolutely needed to be, especially since B was on the financial hook for the renovations, which on an hourly basis were threatening to spiral out of control. Today, Miles got Buster to cover both the breakfast and lunch shifts while he struggled to repair the ancient gas stove at Callahan's, which hadn't been fired up in 20 years. David, who had to prep and serve Mexican night at the grill this evening, had spent most of the afternoon setting up accounts with distributors and doing whatever task could be managed by a man with one good hand. Neither was trying to conceal his involvement in the reopening of Callahan's kitchen, though the story for public consumption was that they were just lending an old friend a hand. One thing was certain. Mrs. Whiting, who knew everything, couldn't possibly not know this. Though maybe David was right, and she was too busy with development office business to sweat the small stuff. Somehow, Miles didn't buy it. They parked behind the dumpster and entered the grill, as always, through the back door. Every day this week, whether coming or going, Miles had half expected to see the Voss boy pacing the lot, staring down at his feet and looking expectant and weary, hungry and lost. When the news of the boy's grandmother broke and he disappeared, Horace Weymouth, feeling guilty about having kept the secret and no longer seeing that much harm could be done, finally told Miles what he'd witnessed out at the old house last month. The howling dog had been chained to the stake, and the boy himself had also been emitting terrible throaty noises as he beat it with a stick. The animal, trying desperately to escape, raced around in ever-shortening circles of panic, the chain bunching up around the stake until it was completely gathered in a ball and the side of the dog's head was held flat to the ground. Even then the poor thing had tried to get away, strangling itself in the process. Only when it finally understood the hopelessness of flight did the boy toss the stick away and begin trying to soothe the terrified creature, staying well clear of its frightened, snapping jaws until it began to calm down and whimper pitifully. Then the boy himself got down on all fours, crawling closer and closer, cooing at the animal, gently stroking its wounded flanks, until the dog finally forgave his attacker and licked his face. Horace realized that the boy was weeping and begging the animal's forgiveness, still careful, though, because it was still bewildered and conflicted, and something would cause it suddenly to quit licking and snap. Then it would resume its whimpering, the boy all the while cooing, I know, as if in perfect understanding. It was, Horace said, the most horrifying and heartbreaking thing he had ever seen. His first impulse was to report what he'd witnessed, and knowing what he knew now, he wished he had. But he'd seen the boy around town and knew something of his family and his standing at the high school, and Horace himself knew what it felt like to be considered a freak. Had he reported what he'd seen, the boy probably would have been removed from his grandmother's home and sent to the juvenile correctional facility in Sunderland, a truly gruesome place. Horace also told Miles something that had not made it into the news reports, that in the same area of the landfill where Charlotte Owen's decaying remains were uncovered, they'd also found the bodies of several dogs, each exhibiting signs of having been tortured or beaten to death. Miles had shared none of this with his daughter, of course, knowing how upset she already was by the boy's disappearance, but he did tell her about the laundry bag and made her acknowledge, for her own safety, what he believed to be true, that John Voss was a tragically abused boy, that something in him was broken, and that simple kindness might not be enough to fix it. Tick had nodded in something less than complete agreement, and in the end he wasn't sure how much of it had taken root. The whole conversation reminded him of the one earlier that year about the separation that would ultimately end in his and Janine's divorce. In both cases, his daughter's greatest need had seemed to be for him to stop talking. Horace and Walt were playing gin when Miles and David came in. Walt had already stripped down to his white-ribbed muscle shirt. How many of these, Miles wondered, did the man own?
Hello, Walt, he sighed. Hi, Horace, Buster.
No more double shifts, Buster said.
Though his eye had cleared up almost completely, he looked like a man who'd spent every last nickel of his strength and energy. You want to go home?
And never come back,
Buster added, stripping his apron off over his neck. Just let me take a quick shower, Miles said. Then you can split.
You see that white limo, big boy? Walt wanted to know. The one with the mass plates?
Miles nodded.
Drove right down the middle of Empire Avenue all the way to the mill. Don't tell me there isn't something in the works, neither. Go outside and sniff. You can still smell the money in the air.
Through the front window, Miles saw Charlene's Hyundai, its signal blinking while she waited to make her turn into the lot. There would be six on tonight, Miles serving as host and floater, David at the stove with an assistant for salads and desserts, Charlene and another girl working the floor, plus the new busboy he'd hired to replace John Voss. For the Empire Grill, a full crew. At B's, with nearly three times as many tables, they'd have to double or triple their staff.
David would have to train at least one other person how to cook noodles twice, and Charlene had already volunteered. That was fine with Miles, though he hated to lose her on the floor, which she owned like no one else. Ironically, Charlene was the only one who'd been looking forward to hustling drinks, which would double her tips. Still, he understood that at 45, after 20-some years and God knew how many miles up and down the floor of the Empire Grill, she wanted and possibly needed a change. That wasn't the only thing he'd come to understand about the woman he'd loved since high school. He also knew that she and his brother were lovers, and probably had been for some time, having agreed to keep this secret in order not to hurt his feelings. David would have argued for honesty, but Charlene would have said no, not yet. The realization had come to him in stages, beginning back in September at the Lamplighter, when he came in and saw Charlene sitting alone in the Half Moon booth. Right next to her draft beer sat David's glass of tonic, the two drinks forming a tableau of intimacy, even in the absence of one of the drinkers. Later, when she'd followed his brother outside, Miles had watched through the window, and something about the way they'd stood together in the parking lot registered without him even knowing. He glanced down the counter at him now, as he too followed Charlene's turn into the restaurant, smiling until he felt his brother's gaze, then meeting Miles's eye. "Yes?" Miles asked, by raising his eyebrows. "Yes," his brother nodded. They might have had more to say on the subject, but the phone rang just then.
"Miles Roby?" said a voice Miles didn't recognize.
"Yeah?"
"Did you know your wife's on Upper Empire Avenue screaming obscenities and kicking in the side of your Jeep?"
"Here," Miles said, handing the phone to the Silver Fox. "It's for you." When he got out of the shower, the phone was ringing again, his private line this time. Janine, he thought. He'd not wanted to divorce his wife, and as their final dissolution drew nearer, it had occurred to him that he might actually miss hearing her piss and moan and rant and rave and sob her heart out. For as long as he'd known her, Janine had kept up a pretty constant head of steam, and in truth, he'd been looking forward to having Walt Como assume the responsibility for releasing her valve. He had no idea what had caused Janine to stop in the middle of Empire Avenue and terrorize her own car, but he was certain her new husband deserved first crack at it. Unfortunately, all Walt had done was grow pale and set the phone back down. But this time he was wrong, though he almost would have preferred it to be Janine on the phone.
"You finished painting the church yet?"
his father demanded, once Miles had accepted the charges. Had Max lost his mind completely or simply forgotten he'd begun their last phone conversation with this precise question? "No, Dad, I haven't."
"Good. You don't want to work for those people."
He knew better than to ask, but couldn't help himself. "What people, Dad? What are you talking about?"
"Those Vatican goons come right into Captain Tony's and lifted Tom right off his bar stool by the elbows."
"Vatican goons?"
"Right," Max said, apparently relieved that they had a good connection. "That was yesterday. I haven't seen him since. The sissy one find his station wagon?"
Miles told him he had, for once refusing to be baited. Earlier in the week, Father Mark had bummed a ride to the coast to retrieve the parish's Crown Victoria.
"Right where I told you it was, I bet."
"Do I understand this, Dad?" Miles said. "You want credit for telling me where you left the stolen car?"
"I didn't steal anything."
"No? How about that 20 you took out of my shirt pocket?"
10, Max corrected him. "So where do you suppose they took him?"
"Someplace safe where he can be looked after?"
"It was safe right where he was. We were looking after him. I thought this was supposed to be a free country, or don't you Catholics believe in freedom?"
"Did you want something, Dad?"
"You could send down some money if you felt like it. You wouldn't believe the price of beer down here. Ain't even the season yet."
Translation: with Father Tom gone, he'd lost his meal ticket, and immediately following this, another thought. How'd they know where to find him?
Who?
Your Vatican goons.
The sissy one must have told them.
I don't think so. You want to know what I think? I think when the money ran out, you called the diocese.
You just don't want to send me any money, Max said.
How come I'm always the one you ask? How come you never ask David?
I do better with you. Some people are a soft touch. Others got harder bark on them. You're like your mother. David's more like me.
For a man who couldn't stay home, you put a lot of faith in genetic logic.
I never doubted your brother was mine, if that's what you're getting at, any more than I doubted you were.
That had been what he was getting at, he realized.
A man knows what's his, you know, Max said. Take yours?
Yes.
How do you know? Blood tests?
Outside on the stairs leading to the apartment, Miles could hear footsteps. Charlene's, unless he was mistaken. Though it wasn't that hard to imagine them as belonging to his mother, as if she'd somehow been summoned by this conversation to resolve their dispute. How much do you need, Dad?
I'm okay for now, he said,
as if he also had wearied of the present conversation.
I'll let you know. First of the month, go over to my place and pick up my check and send it down here, okay?
Okay. Miles hadn't completely shut his door, so Charlene tapped a warning before poking her head inside. Normally, he knew, finding Miles with nothing but a towel wrapped around his middle, she'd have had some smart-ass remark to offer. Not this time. You better come down, was all she said, before pulling the door closed.
Big boy,
Walt was calling excitedly. It always bothered him when something was going on at one end of the counter while he was at the other. It seemed to him not entirely a coincidence, perhaps, that Miles and David and Charlene had all gathered down there out of earshot.
If I'm not back in an hour, Miles told Charlene, his voice low and more under control than he felt, call Brenda. If she can't, try Janine. His ex-wife would host this in a pinch, assuming she'd finished trashing the Jeep.
Someone should go see B, David said. She sounded pretty upset.
Not 5 minutes after Miles and his brother had left Callahan's, two state inspectors had appeared, and within half an hour had shut the place down. The long list of code violations included wiring, which Miles already knew about, filthy inadequate bathroom facilities, no argument there, and rodent droppings in plain sight in the kitchen area, in plain sight only because Miles had pulled both the refrigerator and the stove away from the wall, something nobody had done in more than a decade, so he could work on them. The transgressions against health and safety codes continued down the page, some minor and inexpensive to correct, others more substantial and costly. Under recommended, but not required, the inspectors had suggested a new roof, noting flashing along the interior walls, and estimating that the cost of the required repairs might run as high as $100,000, $20,000 more than Bea and her husband had paid for the business 30 years ago. Can you take half an hour? Miles asked Charlene. At this point, David was the one person who couldn't leave the restaurant. She nodded.
No more than that, David warned her. Thursday's crowd comes early.
Then to Miles. You're the one who should go see B, not Charlene.
I'll go over there as soon as I finish talking to Mrs. Whiting. I've been begging you to go see her for...
And I just realized you were right, Miles told him.
I'm right now, too, his brother assured him. To hell with her. I've seen you when you get like this, Miles. You should wait till you've calmed down. If I had two good arms, I'd make you.
Be glad you don't, Miles heard himself say, then closed his eyes and shook his head, realizing what he'd just said.
I'm sorry.
Until you do something like this to yourself, David lifted his ruined arm, you have no idea what sorry is.
David.
But his brother had already turned away. I've got 150 seafood enchiladas to make, he said. Do what you want.
Charlene took him by the elbow.
Miles, you don't even know for sure she's behind this. It could be a coincidence.
Miles shook his head.
A surprise health inspection the same week as the Liquor Control Board? That had been on Tuesday, the state liquor control agent showing up late in the afternoon in response to allegations that B was serving minors. A second violation, he warned her, as he sat at the bar filling out the paperwork on his clipboard, could result in the loss of her license. When she asked what the first violation was, he'd pointed over to the booth where Tick sat doing her homework. She'd come in just a few minutes earlier, slid into her favorite booth, and pushed aside two half-full glasses of beer that B hadn't had a chance to clear away.
"You aren't going to tell me that girl over there is 21, are you?"
"No, I'm going to tell you she's my granddaughter, and she's not drinking beer, which you can see for yourself."
"She's sitting at a table with glasses of beer. You know the law, Mrs. Majeski," he said, initialing the report. "You can appeal, of course. Otherwise, you'll want to take care of this fine within 60 days.
"Where's Curtis?" B said, referring to the regular state guy.
"I believe the man is retired," he said on the way to the door. When he got there, he stopped. "Oh, Mrs. Majeski, good luck on your new restaurant."
"No," Miles now told Charlene. "That's no coincidence. And next week, when she gets an offer on the place for some stranger, that won't be a coincidence either."
"I know," Charlene conceded. "I do. It's just, I don't know what I'll do if I don't have a job."
"Don't worry about that," Miles said, giving her hand a squeeze, sure of this much anyhow. "Mrs. Whiting isn't going to close the Empire Grill. She wants it open. She wants us all right here. Or me, at least."
Charlene shook her head. "I don't understand."
"I do," he said, meeting her eye. "It took a while, but I do."
"Big boy!" Walt called again. "Come on down here. Today's the great day, my friend. No more running."
He had his elbow planted firmly on the counter, his hand open, fingers wiggling. He was seeing everything clearly, it seemed to Miles, even Walt Como. In marrying Janine, Walt had no doubt hoped to enhance his reputation as a man's man and a smooth operator, the Silver Fox. Now, a week into his marriage, he was beginning to realize that Janine could very well be his unmanning. Behind all the bravado, Miles could see, almost smell, the man's panic, which increased noticeably when he saw Miles coming toward him with a stool, which he set down right across from him on the other side of the counter.
"Jesus," Horace Weymouth said, as if he'd just been dealt a hand of gin the likes of which he'd never seen before.
"Say go, Horace," Miles commanded without looking at him.
"Go,"
said Horace. And Miles slammed the back of Walt's hand onto the formica so hard that three water glasses leapt off it and shattered on the floor. So hard that the Silver Fox's legs shot straight out, and for a split second his whole body was parallel to the counter, a victim of a sudden levitation, the stapled hand his only connection to Mother Earth. At that moment, Miles released him, and it was his hips that struck the hard linoleum floor first, then the back of his head, then both feet, which bounced just once. Then the Silver Fox lay still, his eyeballs having rolled up in their sockets. Miles was already out the door. The gate was still open, but Miles Park